Les colloques du Collège de France.
Without no further delay, I will give the floor to Philippe Aquileas de l'Université Paris-Saclay for his presentation on international space law facing the commercial exploitation of celestial body resources.
Thank you, Nikki. Good afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege to present here at Collège de France my paper on celestial body resources. I would like to thank Professor Samantha Besson for this kind invitation. My talk will trace the evolution of space law from its utopian beginnings to today's challenges marked by commercial ambitions and geopolitical rivalries. Our story begins in 1957 with the launch of Sputnik. For the first time, a human object circulated the Earth, crossing the skies of many countries without protest and affirming two key principles, the freedom of outer space and the non-appropriation of outer space. The United Nations quickly acted with the creation of the COPUOS in 1958 and its legal subcommittee in charge of the progressive development of international space law. COPUOS works on the basis of consensus and makes recommendations to the General Assembly of the United Nations. Since 2022, a working group is dedicated to the legal aspect of space resources activities. But the COPUOS is not the only international forum responsible for setting rules for the use of space resources. The International Telecommunications Union oversees cooperation in the use of the orbit spectrum resource. Ladies and gentlemen, space law is undergoing a profound normative shift. From 1967 to 1979, space law developed through international treaties adopted under the auspices of the United Nations. These instruments established a top-down dynamic where international law guided states in regulating the exploration and the use of outer space. National laws progressively incorporated the principles of international space law to regulate growing commercial activities. But today, national laws drive international debates. Industry practice shapes global technical standards, and these bottom-up dynamics favors strong spacefaring nations with well-established industries such as the US who can impose its standards to the others. And this is typically the case with the law of celestial bodies resources. Precisely on the matter of celestial body resources, the cornerstone is the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which confirmed the principle of non-appropriation. However, 12 years later, the Moon Agreement failed to establish the concept of common heritage of mankind as a universal concept. As it has been said this morning, the Outer Space Treaty, Article 2, proclaims the principle of non-appropriation of outer space, including the Moon and other celestial bodies. All forms of appropriation are prohibited, appropriation by states, but also appropriation by nationals of states, in particular private companies. So it's a complete principle of non-appropriation established by Article 2. And we see here a clear difference with airspace, which is governed by the principle of exclusive sovereignty of states over their airspace, based on the Chicago Convention of 1944. As Maria just explained, the non-appropriation principle is the corollary to the freedom of outer space principle, which include freedom of scientific research, freedom of exploration, freedom of use, and free circulation on celestial bodies. In addition, the Outer Space Treaty also ensures that the outer space will not become a lawless frontier. States are internationally responsible for their national activities in outer space, whether these activities are carried on by public entities or private entities. So if tomorrow a private company violates international space law on the moon, the state of the nationality of the company is responsible. And as a consequence, states have the obligation to authorize and to supervise private activities in outer space. In 1979, the Moon Agreement sought to extend this framework. It applies not only to the Moon, but to all other celestial bodies of our solar system, except the Earth, unless a specific treaty provides otherwise. It reaffirmed the freedom of use and scientific research, but went further by proclaiming the Moon and its resources the common heritage of mankind. This principle was supported by developing countries. In fact, the origin of the treaty is based on a proposal made by Argentina. But USSR opposed it, proposing its proper project, a general convention on the moon, without addressing the question of resources. USSR indeed argued that the Outer Space Treaty had already settled the issue, and USSR also rejected the recognition of property rights on the moon and heritage, concepts that are not compatible with socialism. Ultimately, USSR accepted a compromise drafted by the United States, the establishment of an international regime for resource exploitation would be postponed until such exploitation would become technically feasible. Thus, the Moon Agreement establishes a dual system, an immediate regime according to which states have the right, when conducting scientific investigation, to collect samples on the moon. They also have the right to use mineral and other substances of the moon in quantities appropriate to support their missions. And a deferred regime based on the principle of common heritage of mankind, and based on Article 11, states parties to the treaty undertake to adopt an international regime to govern the exploitation of the resources of the moon, as such exploitation is about to become feasible. The Moon Agreement entered into force in 1984, but nevertheless remains a diplomatic failure, since today only 17 states have ratified the text and no spacefaring nation. For the US, the Article 11 of the Moon Agreement quickly met resistance. We have to go back to the context. Following the shutdown of the Apollo program, the cut in the NASA budget in order to support social programs, and the war in Vietnam, and this conducted to industry layoffs in the space sector, uncertainty. So the Moon Agreement, with the concept of common heritage of mankind, was not a good signal for the industry. The concept was seen as vague and legally insecure. And as a consequence, an intense lobby supported by the technophile community in the Senate consistent also with the US position to the same principle in the field of the law of the sea emerged. Even if the diplomats of the Department of State were ready and open for compromise at the United Nations, the voice of the industry and of their political allies prevailed. So the message was clear: the USA would never sign the Moon Agreement. And with this position, USSR and the other spacefaring nations decided not to sign or not to be party to the Moon Agreement. And this failure marked the end of the golden age of space law. Now, let's turn to the way space law shifted from its initial idealism to a more pragmatic approach, a shift largely shaped by the pressure of commerce, with US law and initiatives leading the way. Yet, multilateralism remains the best avenue to reconcile international cooperation with the commercial exploitation of lunar resources. The retreat from idealism culminated in the US Space Resource Exploration and Utilization Act, adopted in 2015 in the context of the new space economy. Why the US government adopted this act? Because of two private companies, Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries, that lobbied intensively to get recognition of property rights over space resources, presenting highly speculative business models based on asteroid mining and lunar resource exploitation. Today, both companies went bankrupt, revealing the fragile economic foundations of their ambitious claims. Nevertheless, the United States embraced the narrative of commercial feasibility and adopted a law to authorize private companies to exploit the natural resources of celestial bodies, like they did 10 years before when they adopted a law to authorize private companies to operate very high remote sensing satellite systems, and like they did earlier when they passed a law to authorize private companies to operate telecommunication satellites. So you see that three other countries have adopted similar legislations, and some others are to come. The position of these countries is to say that they fully comply with international space law. How is it possible? They argue that Article 2 bans appropriation of celestial bodies, not their resources, since the text remains silent regarding the resources. As a consequence, these states consider that exploitation of the resources of celestial bodies falls under the freedom of outer space, and that the regime established to license private companies to exploit resources of the Moon is the concrete application of Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty, the principle of states' responsibility for their private activities in outer space. In parallel, the United States promoted the Artemis Accords, non-binding arrangements linked to the NASA's program Artemis. The US government explained to its foreign partners, who meet separately, that if they wanted to participate in the NASA's program Artemis, and why not to get some contracts for their industry, it would be welcome to confirm a common vision of international space law. And you see that the Artemis Accords recognize that the extraction and the use of space resources is lawful, and also authorizes the establishment of safety zones in order to protect lunar activities against harmful interference. The result of this diplomatic adventure is incredible. You see that today 56 representatives of states or space agencies have signed the Artemis Accords. And what is interesting is to note that we have some countries that traditionally are supporting the views of the developing countries in the development of space law, namely India, Brazil, Argentina, or Mexico. We also find countries that have signed of or ratified the Moon Agreement, such as France and Australia. So now the question is that recent national laws plus the Artemis Accords cast doubt on multilateralism. Should we abandon multilateralism? The answer is no. Abandoning collective approaches is premature, and we have an excellent model of international cooperation regarding space resources, the model established by the International Telecommunications Union to regulate the use of the spectrum orbit regime, which is a limited natural resource. With principles of international allotment, national licensing, international coordination, and international registration, the ITU radio regulations allow all states to access the resource and to use the resource without harmful interference. Without cooperation, for sure, satellite communications will be blocked by interferences, and there were risks of monopolizations of Earth orbits by private actors or states. With the mechanism established by the ITU, we have progress in technology and in business, development of satellite telecommunication economy, which is the most important business dealing with space today, and collective interest with programs aimed at bridging the digital divide or operating remote sensing satellites to protect environment and prevent natural disasters. This is why the working group at COPUOS remains essential. In July 2025, it released a draft of recommended principles. And you see that for the very first time, we have two definitions: the definition of space resource, which includes all extractable abiotic materials, that is to say minerals, waters, gases, ice, and the definition of space resource activities, including prospecting, extracting, processing, and transporting. We have also a core of set of principles in line with the Outer Space Treaty, conformity with freedom of outer space, non-appropriation, peaceful purposes, no harmful interference, sustainability, transparency, info sharing, consultations, and state responsibility for private actors. So these principles are not, one very interesting remark is that the working group assumes exploitation as lawful since its mandate is to design the regime for it. So it's no more question to discuss whether or not the exploitation is lawful, and from this perspective, the US has already prevailed in the normative debate. So the regime, the principles are not yet a regime, but they are a blueprint. They could even be seen as a delayed implementation of Article 11 of the Moon Agreement. Although I recognize we are not in the same spirit of centralized benefit sharing, the draft offers at least a realistic compromise, allowing resource use, but within a shared framework of responsibility. So My position, and I'm happy to see that it's the same than the position of Maria, is that it is time to revive the Moon Agreement. And it is possible to revive the Moon Agreement and to try to find, to meet the objectives of those that want to encourage commercialization of the resources and those that want to go back to multilateralism. So, and to have at least an international regime. So reviving the Moon Agreement is also in line with the position of the United Nations, according to which the five treaties form a coherent whole. It restores legal certainty for private actors, and it reaffirms multilateralism as cornerstone of space governance. In conclusion, the history of space law reflects a tension between idealism and realism, between cooperation and competition, and the risk today is that unrestrained commercialization fragments the legal order. But we have a choice. To propose a governance for the model for the Moon is to propose a governance model for humanity itself. And there exists other path than the race for profit and power, a vision where cooperation, equity, and shared responsibility prevailed. Thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.